Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, we're live at the Public Radio Engineering Conference. Chris Tobin's along, and Rich Parker's going to join us, too. It's all coming up on This Week in Radio Tech.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by the new Ruby console from Lavo. See Lavo in your future at lavo.com/twert. And by the Telos Alliance and ZipStream processing and streaming software and hardware. Choose your platform and stream like you mean it.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. It's episode 389. Kirk Harnack and Chris Tobin here. We're live at the Public Radio Engineering Conference in Las Vegas, Nevada. It precedes the NAB show. This is where all the public radio engineers get together and receive just lots of new information from speakers, from other engineers, from people who are in the trenches every day doing this kind of thing, doing the engineering thing. And our show today is brought to you by our friends at the Telos Alliance. We'll be showing you the new Infinity IP intercom system now shipping. And we'll also be brought to you by our friends at Lavo and the Ruby console. We'll show you a video of that as well. So hang on. We've got an hour ahead of us now where we're going to talk to a number of engineers and presenters from here at the show. Speaking of presenters, my buddy Chris Tobin was a presenter yesterday. Hey, yes. Chris, welcome in.
Thank you.
I don't have to ask where you are today or how's the weather.
No, the weather's great. I'm right here next to you in Las Vegas. We're having a great time. It's good.
So talk to us about your presentation yesterday. What did you talk about?
My presentation was on the wireless first mile for outside broadcasts, remotes, whatever you want to call it, and generating revenue with that. Now, people say, oh, it's easy. We do remotes. We make money off them already. Yes, you do. But I know of a lot of places, and one of them called me out of Philadelphia, that was having problems doing remotes in a sports bar environment. The sports bar had 22 locations.
Well, wait a minute. You've got experience with remotes from sports bars.
Yes.
Okay. They called the right guy.
Yeah. So my buddy calls me up and says, hey, you know, they have this issue, and do you think you could help out? I was like, well, sure. I have a very simple rate. It's very flat rate and forward thinking. He goes, okay, how much? Okay, good. Let's talk. I have to say that because this was not a freebie. I had to make sure it was not, because the radio station's making money off this, so I'm not giving away stuff for free. And neither should any other engineer. So we went down to Philadelphia and talked to the folks, and the owner of the station says, well, here's the problem. We want to be in the bar with our sports show host. However, the place we want to be, we can't, because we have to run the wires from the ISDN and or Ethernet connection for the broadband across the floor, around the blah, blah, blah. And the bar owner is concerned, and he's rightfully so, trip hazards. So we came up with a wireless solution, very simple setup. And the solution we used was two Ubiquiti radio devices.
Yeah.
One with an Omni antenna in the manager's office where the cable modem was located.
Ah, right there.
And then the other unit was the 2x2 MIMO, the little nano station, the rectangular antenna unit. Maybe I should show you. So this here is what we used.
Oh, and we're using this right now.
This is being used right
now. This is live on the air right now.
Yeah, this is the setup we have.
Okay.
So, yes, and the ketchup bottle was in use. There are pictures to prove it. So we did that, and they loved it. They loved the fact that they could go anywhere in the sports bar. So at first I thought, all right, that's pretty no-brainer. After the event was done, it was the Philadelphia Flyers. Flyers. Team was in, so that's a high profile. You can imagine picture taking, all the chaos.
Yeah.
A couple of weeks later, I got a call. Can you come back down and meet the sales manager and general manager and a few other folks at the station? They have some questions. I'm like, okay. The question was, can we do this again at their other location in another part of Philadelphia? I said, sure. Mm-hmm. Okay. Can we do it here? I said, you could do it there. You could do it here. Okay. So they did. And for the entire season, we did 22 locations, 27 broadcasts with a wireless link so they could go anywhere inside the restaurant. That was the problem. The sales manager said, well, we want to be at this location inside the bar at this one. But the other one, we want to be here. I said, yeah, you can do that.
Okay.
So then I instructed or suggested, why don't you guys make a little map or a list of locations you've been doing and keep it so that the next time you get a call, hey, can you do something from such and such place? You look at your list. Absolutely. We've been there twice. We're done. So now you're not waiting 2 weeks to install the ISDN. You're waiting a day or 12 hours to find your little kit, the wireless kit, and get out there.
Now, I got to ask you about setting up. You said at the first location you mentioned, you had to put an Omni antenna with a Wi-Fi hotspot from Ubiquiti in the manager's office.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, like this.
The bullet.
Now, these are pretty inexpensive. You could just leave this at the bar so it's always there.
You can make arrangements with – yeah. Now, I'm just giving you a very 50,000 foot view of what you could be doing.
Uh-huh.
If you're a regular station, a sports station in a market, odds are you're going to be coming back to this location quite often. You may have a regular program there. So what you should do is then have a relationship and say, hey, we're going to make this more permanent so we can be here more often, more quickly.
Yeah.
Now, somebody was like, well, that means this. I said, no, if you're using this equipment, now you have an intern or a part-timer can take the stuff real easy. As you can see, it's as simple as a ketchup bottle.
Yeah.
Place it in a place you already know works.
Yeah.
And you're up and running. It took us less than 8 minutes. I timed it to plug in, power up the unit, plug in a laptop, and start streaming the both video. Although I mentioned we're doing video over for the website, for the Facebook, and we did the audio over IP with their Comrex Access on the same connection. And matter of fact, two or three of those broadcasts, I was there doing twerk, as you remember.
Yes,
as you're
okay.
Pointing out that we've done sports broadcasts. So we did three broadcast events off this one link, and the trick was we controlled it. This is the point of the presentation. Yes, this room that we're in right now at the PREC has two Wi-Fi access points attached to the wall. Yes, we could have easily been using that for today's broadcast. However, I don't know what's happening at that because it's a public, so to speak, access point for this entire room.
Yeah, there's
so I'm sharing bandwidth with over 200
people.
Now, somebody said, well, that access point can handle 275. I know the spec. That's nice. But I don't know how it's being managed after that.
Right.
However, I went to the ISP that's providing this great support, and I said, can I grab a spigot, if you will, off your switch? All I need is maybe 10 megabits up and down for my podcast.
Right.
Sure, we can hook you up. Turns out they placed us on the management LAN of their broadband distribution. Now, anyone who's done this before knows that management LAN is not the same LAN as the access point for the public.
Right.
Which means the bandwidth we are getting is not tainted with traffic from the public.
Tainted, that's a great word. Okay? Yes, it's not
so
tainted.
The key is not the bandwidth as much as latency and jitter on the network.
Uh-huh.
Our jitter and latency is, the jitter, the ping time was 4 milliseconds.
Right.
If you go on the public Wi-Fi they have for everybody here, I tested it, it's 35 milliseconds.
Okay.
Now, granted, it's not that much.
That's not
but
bad,
the point is, there is a difference.
Yeah.
So I create my link. I just showed you. And also, I do use WPA AES for security. So the link is not available for anybody to grab.
Right.
No one's phone is going to see it and try to ping to it and try to do anything. It doesn't matter. And what I also do is do the reduced bandwidth. I don't need 400 megabit link. All I need is a nice 10 megabits back and forth. So I reduce the bandwidth to 5 megs. Makes it nice and robust.
So you reduce the RF bandwidth.
RF bandwidth, the data rate bandwidth, everything. The channel is not...
Hey, give us a little bit of, we've never really talked about this much. Give us a little bit of education on the relationship between the RF bandwidth of a Wi-Fi hotspot or an IP radio link and the data rate you can do over that. And I'll preface it by saying, you know, we've talked about the IP radio links that I've done to run live wire to my transmitter sites. And I've got three transmitter sites now where I'm running 1, 2, or even 4 live wire streams back and forth. And at the last one that I built was in American Samoa, short link with the Ubiquiti the air fiber.
Air fiber.
Yeah. Yes. So, I mean, all the signal strength we could possibly use. But the transmitter site had a lot of other 5.8 gig there, and we were unlicensed, so who knows where they're going to move to. And I thought, you know what? I want to be as secure as I can. Let me see what happens if I narrow this down to 10 megahertz of bandwidth, because the default is either 20 or 40 megahertz of bandwidth. Mm-hmm. Narrowed it to 10 megahertz. I noticed my calculated top throughput could not have been as much, but it was still way more than I needed for the live wire streams. Mm-hmm. And I didn't need to. So I felt like, oh, and I noticed that at the receive end, at each receive end, when I narrowed it, when I told it, you're getting a 10 megahertz RF bandwidth signal. That's what you're looking for. The carrier to noise ratio went way up. Or in other words, I needed a lot less carrier to have a usable signal. Now, talk to me about that relationship and RF bandwidth throughput and all that kind of stuff.
Well, that's known as Shannon's Law.
Okay.
And those of you who are RF people know exactly what I'm talking about, but I'm not going to go into detail. You can look this up. Bell System came up with this. Professor Shannon. It's basically the description is the more data rate you want or bandwidth, you need more channel spacing because the noise. In order the energy to go across the channel, mm-hmm. you have to have more space and more energy. So at 40 megabits, at 40 megahertz, you can have, say, 100 megabits. But if you want 200 megabits or 1 gig, you're going to have to go to 80, which means the number of channels increases. So if you're in 5.8, you have number of channels. I forget what it is. 12 or 13.
And these channels are just are arbitrary channelizations.
Well, it's a channel.
It's RF bandwidth.
It's RF bandwidth. So you have 5.1 to 5.8, whatever the channel's allotment is. So if I want to do, say, 400 megabits, right? Everybody's hot on getting bandwidth. That's probably, I think, six channels in the RF spectrum. So six channels get aggregated together to create this pipe.
Yeah.
So, yes, the carrier to noise is going to go up or down because now you have a larger carrier. The noise floor didn't change. The noise floor may be at minus, say, 80 or minus 70 in some places. But in order to get over that, you want a smaller pipe going through the noise. And that's the difference. I mean, that's in very simplest terms. And I know there are people who are like, no, you got to do this. It's like understanding that relationship is key. But the other important thing is it's not always just how much bandwidth or data rate. And we had a discussion yesterday on one of the other what was it called? Ubiquity Optimization by Jeff.
Oh, Jeff Holdenrid. Yeah, he's been a guest on our show
exactly,
before.
Exactly, yeah. From Double Radius. And it was a perfect segue from him to me because he talked about the technical side of it. Like, hey, folks, if you're only running – and he made a joke. He says, look, how many of you have had STLs that were a Intraplex? We use a brand name.
Yeah.
And everyone raised their hand. Great. So your maximum throughput was 1.544 in each direction. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. And yet you managed to do your business. And you also had a data card on there for serial data, or maybe you did a small Ethernet link. Yeah. Okay. So we're talking, we'll just round it up, 2 megabits in both directions, and you got your job done. So then why are you putting in a IP radio link and demanding 400 megabits and compromising your link quality because you're going with more than, say, 2 or 3 channels and your bandwidth and noise floor? The room went silent. So bring it in.
Yeah.
And you'll be surprised how much you can get through, say, on a 20 megahertz or 10 megahertz setup. And the other thing was he talked about, remember, we're talking RF. And at these frequencies, antennas are important. So the other part that I did with this broadcast setup and I've done for other projects is look at the antenna pattern. Many of you may not understand how that works. That's important to talk to folks who do, like Double Radius and other companies. Ubiquity has a great information on their site. So does Cambium and I think what's the other company, SAF or something like that. And understand the antenna design. Mm. So so a question came up yesterday. Well, if I use 2-foot dishes on both ends and saturate this RF, wouldn't that work? Well, yeah, you'll saturate the RF. But all of us who work in digital know too much digital bit streams into a decoder. What happens? It falls apart because bit error occurs.
Yeah.
So now you have to make sure that the RF signal is not too much, but not too little. So again, it's a balancing act. It's not difficult to do because these companies like, say, Ubiquity with the bullet, their dashboard gives you all that information.
Yeah.
You can sit there with a slider and watch the data rate as you point it out, go up and down, go up. That's what I need. I don't need. Then they do it in the newer versions. This is the old one. The newer versions have the ability to do a loop test. So you can actually do a latency loop test or speed test on your link. The software is designed to do that. So it will actually go out to the far end and come back and give you, here's what's going on. So you have all the tools to make it work. Just understand the design of what's happening.
You know, one example, I learned at least operationally about this trade-off between bandwidth and receiver sensitivity. Mm-hmm. Back in the days, remember, not much used anymore, but back in the day, a lot of people used Marti brand for STL.
Same principle.
The old STL-8, the STL-10, and Marti, now they eventually did a composite STL, but for years you would just have single channel STLs. And if you wanted stereo, you would use 2 of these radios combined into a combiner and then a splitter at the receive end, but they were single channels. And so the RF bandwidth was pretty narrow compared to composite. Composite, to shoot that to a transmitter site, you're talking about a fairly wide, I forget just how much it is, but a fairly
wide. Like 200 kilohertz wide.
Yeah.
192 kilohertz for your subcarrier, composite, everything else.
Yeah. So you'd shoot this, and I remember that, you know, the signal strength I was always looking for at the transmitter site, the receive signal strength for a composite, at least 400 microvolts and preferably a millivolt.
Sure.
You know, 1,000 microvolts, a millivolt of signal to saturate my receiver for a composite link. Whereas with Marti stuff, 200 microvolts was plenty. And honestly, 60 or 70 microvolts would work.
The bandwidth differences.
So the composite receiver is, it's looking at something, it's looking for signal over this wide, mm-hmm. and it takes more power to do that. So same thing in the IP radio world. Yes. If you buy a Ubiquity Air Fiber 5 and you actually need it to get a gigabit through, well, you're going to need every advantage. I mean, that's under absolutely ideal conditions, including setting those bandwidths. Maybe it's even 80 megahertz, but it's a wide bandwidth transmit and receive
right.
in both directions, and or the direction that you need a gigabit. You got to have plenty of signal strength. And my, and I'm sure there's people doing it, but in my experience, I don't know how you do that in the real world. I've never gotten that, but I'm also not trying to get it. I'm also, oh, the other thing is the modulation scheme. So you might see in digital radios different selections for a modulation scheme. Sometimes it's called MCS.
MCS is QAM, quadrature.
If you look up, I didn't know, you know, in one of the Ubiquiti radios I had, it listed the MCSs, but it didn't. It listed the MCS scheme number.
Yeah.
But that did, the description in the field didn't tell you what that meant. But if you go to Wikipedia, MCS is a standard term apparently. Mm-hmm. You can go look up what all the different MCS levels imply mm-hmm. in terms of the QAM level and all
right.
this kind
the of MCS is sort of like an auto tuning, auto gain control. It looks at the RF bit error rate and tries to compensate to maintain the integrity of the link in the digital domain.
So
if you're having interference issues yeah. or you're not or too much RF, it tries to compensate for that. So you can select where you want to have the thresholds.
So the high, if you want to get a gigabit through on an IP radio, you had to select the high MCS number
right.
that would give you 256 QAM. So the radio is making possible 256 different symbols
yeah.
to be received. And that's a symbol is a combination of amplitude and phase.
Right. Quadrature, that's where it comes from.
And so anyway, the point there is it can get a lot of data through, but it's not necessarily all that, shall we say, robust. It's a little bit brittle.
But see, it is robust if the distance between the two endpoints is within Shannon's law of what you need for RF, for bit error rate, for the signal strength. Just
right.
as we talked about with the Marti and with the Mosley, say, or Marti STLs, your composite needs, say, 2 millivolts to be good because that's a signal to noise. An analog, it's signal to noise. So we need more signal than noise in order for the decoder to get what we want for noise for dynamic range and your noise for your composite, the decoder. Marti, if you remember, the RPU systems, the frequencies, had certain deviations that you could work. The deviation in analog dictates the modulation, how much you can use. So if you had a group S Marti, which was the 450.925,
yeah.
455.925 frequency, that was for wideband FM, or for, you know, for high-quality audio.
Right.
But if
right.
you looked at the deviation or that channel's bandwidth was 100 kilohertz. So the deviation on that transmitter was greater than the one on the group N and group J channels, which was half or a third.
Hey, our guest here.
Oh, excellent. We can get back to this.
Yeah, we'll can you grab a headset.
You have to don the headset there.
Grab a headset. And slip over here next to...
You dropped Ian's card. That's Ian Gunn.
Slip
from
over here.
We're talking
hey,
about.
Steve. How are you? Good, good.
Well, indeed.
So you're on here with thousands of others. Hey, Victoria, how are you? Could you join us after Steve? Awesome. Thank you.
Well, it should be ladies first.
Oh, my.
Modern about it.
So let's see. Yes, looks like we're all on the camera. That's excellent. Yeah. So Steve Johnson is here. Steve is serving as the president of yeah. APRE, the Association of Public Radio Engineers. Lots of alphabet soup here, but the APRE puts on the PREC. Is
that's
that right?
True. Yeah, that's its main function is to provide that conference here for public radio engineers. It's a way to network, first and foremost. Secondarily, education from vendors, from experts in the field, and from your colleagues. And our mission is being accomplished beautifully here at the show.
It is. How many participants have you got this year?
There's 105 registered guests
okay.
here, and more than that, though, because we have quite a few guests who are presenting or on a panel or something like that, so more like maybe 130-some.
Now, I've been honored to present here a couple times in the past. The PREC seems to have presentations of super high quality, chock full of information.
Well, I'm glad that's your perception. We really work hard at it. It's... I think one of the conferences that delivers tremendous value, where it's held in an affordable location, it's providing top-notch presenters and a very good attendance, so you have plenty of people to work with in a networking setting.
Steve, where are you engineering yourself?
Well, I'm working as a consultant out of Wisconsin, mm-hmm. and it's kind of new for me to be a consultant, so... This is an opportunity for me to say I'm available.
So what are your specialties in consulting?
Well, I'm very strong in RF, and that's becoming harder and harder to find.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I've been doing a lot of lately is providing long-range planning, strategic planning, for customers whose own engineering teams don't have the long perspective of broadcasting. I've been around more than 30 years and seen all the changes that we've gone through. And that perspective helps. It's not the total answer, but it helps to see what the future might hold.
Do you have any prognostications you'd like to share on our show?
Well, I think the number one driving force is the demand for metadata. Program-associated data, and it might be visual in nature, it might be textual. I'm surprised, you know, young people, particularly today, are glued to their phones reading text messages and other social media. That's reading, that's text. We want that on the radio as well, and so a lot of the presentations do have that orientation. I was a pioneer in that. We did a show together on that subject when I was doing emergency alerting through HD radio, PAD, and FM-RDS. And that is now catching on really mainstream, so that's gratifying in a way. We had several presentations this morning on that topic.
You mentioned how young folks, millennials and others, you know, they go through their Twitter feed, their Facebook feed, whatever it is, and so many people who are posting on Facebook, posting a video, know that the viewer is not necessarily going to hit the button for audio.
Yeah.
And so they put a closed caption text or they make sure they textualize.
It's a multimedia experience, no matter what. They want to cover all those possible bases. So it's not alien to radio to want to do the same. I was talking to some of our colleagues who put on a TV version of this conference, and they were talking about how much harder their challenge is to do video for the members or live streaming and all. I said, that's because your expectations are probably higher than the radio team. But there is a minimum level where you're getting the information across, you're providing the content that people want. How can you go wrong at that?
So I've noticed that several companies are now offering pretty much instantaneous speech-to-text capabilities.
It is interesting, and I think a friend of mine was sort of a leader in that. He, at ENCO, was very interested in that topic as a way to handle profanity delay and dumping out.
Yeah.
And so he was watching, and but that provided that technology, that idea of speaking or turning speech into text, one or the other, both directions. Is that the convergence that's coming when it doesn't matter how you communicate, it'll be interchangeable?
You know, one of the I work for the folks at Telos, and one of our partners is Broadcast Bionics.
Oh, yeah.
And they've developed a system whereby very quick speech to text, and then you can edit clips out of your show, not based on squiggly waveforms, but based on the words that were said.
That's
and I want to find out, okay, how often did my guest say Margaret Thatcher? And I can go find that. And this also makes radio searchable on Google.
Yeah, that was a problem that I was trying to grapple with at WPR when I was there. They were interested in having a rich archive. We have a history there from 1917 onward. And, of course, not all that material is saved. But we had a rich archive. But how to find what you want? Metadata is one way. When you have program-associated data, you can search through that data. This would be, in my vision, a way to build more metadata for either pre-recorded material or live material. A lot of stations don't have the resources to transcribe things manually, or this is going to be good for that.
Yeah.
I think so. There's newcomers. We invite newcomers to the show all the time. That's one of our main drives, and they talk about this sort of thing all the time. We offered scholarships this year, four of them actually, a sort of all-expense-paid visit to PREC, and that I hope it's attracting people who are having thoughts like this.
Good deal. Steve, I appreciate you coming by.
Well, thank you very much.
I'm sorry, I hogged. Anything you want to ask?
No. You guys, I didn't want to get in the way. That's fine.
Chris sat back and watched the action here. Thank you very much.
Steve, thank you so much for
stopping
by.
Thanks for coming.
I appreciate it very much. And I think, Victoria, can you talk to us for a sec? Awesome. So, Victoria St. John, and I still don't believe that's her real name because that's such a radio name.
Thanks, Mom and Dad.
come on in here. step right up. You'll be in the camera. Come on in. Come on in. There we go. Hi, right. How you doing?
Hi, I'm doing great.
Good
thank
to see you.
Nice to see you.
I think I met you 10 years ago or more. Richard Parker introduced us.
Yes.
And I see he's here today, too.
He is.
Rich is, yes.
He's now with Alaska Public Radio.
Yes, and you're still in Vermont, is that
I'm still at Vermont Public Radio. Yeah, I'm the operations person there.
Oh, okay. Well, now, you've been emceeing this event.
Yeah, right? This is my third or fourth year emceeing the event.
scholarships we were talking about. Kira is up in Vermont, right?
Yes, yes.
That was last year or the year before?
Year before.
Right.
I met Kira Parker. And,
I met her too, yeah.
She came to mind when our RF engineer decided to retire. So we brought her in. And this is what Steve was mentioning about networking.
That's why
getting
I bring
to
it up,
know people.
I remember her first time here.
Yeah, exactly. So Kira has a new job in Vermont thanks to the networking that she did here at the PREC.
Cool. So tell me about operations. Now, you were your public radio network. Yeah?
That's right. Okay. Yeah, a statewide network in Vermont.
So it seems like a lot of the talk here is kind of geeky engineering stuff. What do you take away from this kind of conference for your own use?
Well, it's geeky engineering, but it's also how everything integrates and weaves into the big picture. So we're trying to grow and develop the APRE to involve more people as the business is evolving away from strictly RF. We're now multi-platform delivery. How we do things, how different departments view and workflows and evolve. That's a role that I've enjoyed playing here, is giving different perspectives and bringing beyond RF engineering perspective to the PREC.
Seems to me that one of the challenges that radio has, and I think we're beginning to meet it in various ways, is creating content once, but having it modified appropriately for different delivery platforms.
Exactly. It's also a state of mind. We've grown from this digital versus broadcast, and that's the wrong way to look at it. We've evolved now into, or we are evolving into, We're creating content, whether it be delivered on traditional terrestrial broadcast or multi-platform delivery. So it's how we look at it, how we think about it. Podcasting has brought a whole new dimension to that.
Yeah.
So there's a lot to think of, and the networking aspect and different points of view are so important as this business evolves from strictly terrestrial to multi-platform.
So one of those platforms is smart speakers. And,
yes,
you know, a bazillion of those were sold this past Christmas.
Yes, they were.
It was funny. If you went to try to order a Google Home Mini, the delivery time was put it well into January. But you could go to Best Buy, and they had racks of them that were disappearing quickly. I already had two or three smart speakers in my home. I think I bought two or three more and then bought some more for gifts. And we're really enjoying them. My 7-year-old son sets his alarm every morning, you know. She who shall not be named, wake me, set an alarm for 6:30 a.m., you know. And he's discovered sleepy time music to go to sleep by. So he likes that.
Yeah, we've had to develop a whole new way of promoting the smart speaker aspect of radio to our listeners, to remind them you can do this by asking for your public radio station.
That was going to be my next question. And so do you find that your listeners tend to ask for your live stream, or are they asking for shows that you've produced, as in podcasts? Refit what you do and then educate your listeners as to what they can get?
Well, you take a conscious approach to it. We mm-hmm. actually have, not only on our website, but in live read promos, smart speaker invitations on how to learn how to use it, how to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
So we are consciously promoting listening to Vermont Public Radio via a smart speaker.
This reminds me of the days when an AM station would get a new FM license, and then they would tell their listeners how to pick up their FM station,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's cross-promotion of what you're already doing. It's selling yourself in a whole new way.
Now, of course, a lot of stations simply make their live stream available via TuneIn or via their own app, whatever it may be, on a smart speaker. My little poor radio stations are doing both. We have an app for your phones, and then we're on TuneIn, and so smart speakers find that just fine.
Yes.
Is there another one or two key things that a broadcaster like you do to make sure you're more smart speaker friendly and easier to find?
Well, like I said, that promotion, making sure it's on your website. When you do mailings for pledge drives, make sure there is a mention there about smart speaker.
Okay.
It's a reminder as much as it is an education, because a lot of people got smart speakers for Christmas this year.
How, if at all, are your engineers involved with your own promotional and content efforts.
It's funny you say the word engineers, because what that term means is changing. IT people are now working in areas that didn't necessarily used to be traditionally engineering.
Yeah.
So we have a crew of smart people with a technical background working as a team. Part of what we're trying to bring here is different skill sets to our evolving industry.
Awesome. We're going to have to break for a commercial. I kind of forgot about commercial. We had some exciting guests. And
the smart speakers and all that stuff.
Yeah.
It's just like when radio stations had a new radio show they're going to promote from the network. It's the same principle. It's augmenting what we do already.
Yeah, yeah.
So is all the other platforms. It's not a separate business. I don't know why people keep thinking that.
Well, because it's that evolving.
You can evolve, but it's still augmenting what we do. Because the engine that runs it is still the radio concept.
Is there the thought much at all that, we need to hire some young folks to handle this part of it because only they understand it?
I disagree. Only young people understand it.
Yeah.
Some of the people I work with are not necessarily so young, and they're smart, and they get it.
Okay.
Years of experience.
Victoria, thank you so much
for
joining
us.
I appreciate you taking a few minutes of your time. And we're going to take a quick break right here and listen to one of our sponsors from the Telos Alliance and the new IP intercom called Infinity. Take it away.
Hi, I'm Martin Deister, Vice President of Business Development and Product Director for Telos Infinity IP Intercom System. Telos Infinity is different to any other intercom system because it's the first IP intercom system that doesn't have a matrix. Great communication within the broadcast environment is essential to TV and radio production. With Telos Infinity, you can link all your production crew, whether it's the director in the production control room, sound guy in the booth, boom operator on the floor, your anchors in the studio, presenters out in the field, weatherman, even your weatherman. Production staff listening to communications audio are hearing crystal clear sounds. It means the nuances of the people communicating with them can be heard all the time. Everything is crystal clear and accurate. The master intercom panels that we've created include multicolor LCD switches. You can use color coding to group IFBs, to group production crew members, your remotes, anybody else. Matrix-free intercom means low cost of entry, low cost of design, low cost of installation from the get-go. With Telos Infinity, you start saving money the moment you install it, and you continue to save money for the life of the product. The same benefits that broadcasters all around the world have found by using audio over IP now apply to intercom for the very first time. Never before have you been able to communicate using program quality audio simply by connecting two devices into a network switch. It truly is plug and play. Programming an intercom system has never been easier than it is with Telos Infinity. With our advanced dashboard programming utility, you can have your intercom system out of the box and up and running in record time. I'm Martin Deister, inviting you to visit telosalliance.com to learn more about Telos Infinity Broadcast Optimized Intercom System, the first matrix-free IP intercom system optimized for broadcast.
Hey, good afternoon. This is Kirk Harnack on This Week in Radio Tech. Oh, by the way, thanks a lot to the Telos Alliance and to Martin Deister and to the new IP intercom from Telos called the Infinity. We appreciate their sponsorship and interest in the show. Thanks for your sponsorship and interest, too. And by the way, I should mention that that IP intercom is now shipping. We've already shipped the first one to the first customer. The next one is on the way out the door. And we're going to be using the Infinity IP intercom in its very first on-air broadcast application this coming Tuesday as we bring you the Legends of Audio live webcast from the Telos Alliance booth here at NAB. Frank Foti will be interviewing four legendary audio engineers and producers in a live webcast. We'll get more information out about that. We'll have it on the Tort Facebook channel, so stay tuned. You get to hear more about that. All right? All right. Chris, you all right?
I'm good.
I'm hearing a tone. Is it me? It's in the room. Okay, there's tone in the room. All right.
They must be tuning in.
It must be room tone.
Room tone.
Welcome back. And we have with us Bruce Wall. Hi, Bruce.
Hi, Kirk. How are you?
Welcome
Good to
in.
See you.
So Chris and Bruce are both here, and we're going to talk about Bruce's participation. What are they doing? They running a I hear tone, but I see
they're
no bars.
Sweeping the room.
Good gosh. Bruce, your position, you've been honored this year by...
I am being honored, yes. I'm very happy about that. I was flabbergasted when I first learned of it. Steve Johnston, the president of APRE, called me about 2 or 3 weeks ago and said, you know, you're coming to the PREC? And I said, yes. and he says, well, I want you to know that you've been selected as the 2018 Achievement Award winner. And I'm going, are you kidding me?
Awesome.
So I was
awesome.
Completely flabbergasted and very pleased, very gratifying.
Well, now, you're a humble gentleman. You really are.
Well, I try to be.
But what do you think what do you think caught the attention of those who select who's the honoree?
Well, I served as a founding board member of APRE until I term limited out after 8 years.
Okay.
And so so I'm well known by the people here.
Yeah.
And I've been with NPR either as an employee or a consultant since the founding of the company in 1971.
Wow.
And so I think longevity may have had something to do with it.
Mm-hmm.
I try to be a contributor and my achievements, my accomplishments are relatively well known in this small group.
Mm-hmm.
And so, all I can say is I'm honored and thrilled.
Now your card says NPRDS. Tell me what that is.
That's NPR Distribution Services. Mm-hmm. It used to be called NPR Satellite Services.
Ah.
But we've expanded, our portfolio to include other methods of distribution besides, satellite delivery. And I work for the distribution division, the public radio satellite system within NPR. And I've been doing that since I returned to the company back in 2003.
That brings up a kind of a forward-looking question. Will there ever be a day when terrestrial distribution completely supplants satellite? Or as far as we know, we'll always have a need for satellite distribution?
It's a great question. And you probably don't know that for the past 4 years, I've also been working at PBS. I am the NPR distribution liaison to PBS, and they are involved with a new distribution system. And their file delivery system that they are in the process of implementing right now, they call it SIX, which is... I forget what the acronym stands for exactly,
but
it's the sixth generation distribution system. And up until now, it has been all satellite based. This is a terrestrial based system, and but only for their file delivery. But at PBS, you know, 80% or better, or maybe 90% of their program material is actually capable of being, it's pre-produced and available as files,
yeah,
as opposed to public radio, where 80% of it is live,
yeah,
and 20% of it is pre-recorded. So at any rate, I think we're seeing at PBS, we're seeing just exactly what you asked about. That is migrating to a terrestrial-based system. They're putting in 100 megabit MPLS circuits to their members,
mm-hmm,
and they've selected a company out of San Diego called Vigor, who is providing... they're providing a service. They're actually not providing equipment per se. They're providing a service to handle delivery of the file-based material to the stations. And actually, from what I've seen so far, it looks very promising and very interesting, and it doesn't use satellite.
So give us a little bit of wisdom here. If you're giving advice to younger engineers or people interested in broadcasting or the intersection of IT and broadcasting, what advice do you have for them? Where should young people interested in technology, but they're also interested in this world of broadcasting, netcasting, getting out to the masses, mass media, where should people focus their studies?
Wow, what a good question. I don't know that I have a good answer, but it's really, you know, I started out very young. I first got on the air when I was 13 years old. And, but there was nothing digital about that.
Sure.
Except for the power switch. And, it was, I've just kind of evolved with the industry.
Yeah.
And so I, when I started at NPR, there was, nothing there that was, digital per se, because it was in 71. But, you know, long about the late 70s, we got involved in, automation for our satellite broadcasting system. Wow. And that I was the project manager for that in 1979 through 83. And we learned from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, who had done that same sort of thing.
So
I have kind of evolved with the industry. you know, what your company specializes in, audio over IP, is something that I'm still not all that familiar with. I mean, I'm gaining more familiarity with it, and I find it to be fascinating, and I'm learning a lot about it. But, you know, there's a lot to learn.
Sometimes I remind people I was at the NAB convention in Atlanta, Georgia, when it was held there way back a long time ago. And I saw a gentleman who had just received a demonstration of a product that was DSP-based. He turned to his friend. They were both farm broadcasters from Iowa. And we turned to his friend and he said, you know, this here digital is the coming thing.
I believe it is.
I
believe it is.
So were you involved with the original NPR satellite rollout?
Absolutely.
And I was working at an NPR station at the time.
Which one?
This was WEKU FM in Richmond, Kentucky.
Yeah. Eastern Kentucky University.
Yeah. And this is also new that the engineers believed that they needed to, because of some terrestrial microwave in the neighborhood, they had to shield the dish.
Yep.
They dug a trench. Now, that satellite better not move in the sky because the trench just had one aim, you know.
Right,
They put the dish down in that trench, and then they had to, I guess they fibered. Did they have fiber then?
No.
They coaxed an IF frequency under the road and into the building.
Yeah, there was a lot of that at the outset.
Okay.
Now, but when I started with NPR, we used AT&T long lines. It was 5 kilohertz radio service.
I remember the day we switched. And all of a sudden, Bob Edwards sounded completely different.
He did. And he still sounds different.
So what was the brand of the satellite receivers back then, the SCPC receivers?
Coastcom.
Coastcom. That's right.
And I don't know how long you want to talk. I mean, I can go on for hours about this stuff because I was there. But the original experimentation with satellite delivery started in the mid-1970s. And so we were operational with AT&T long lines, 5 kilohertz circuits, monaural, about a 35 dB signal-to-noise ratio.
Not
the best you could get at the time.
Yeah.
And so we started by doing an experiment with Western Union. Westar 1 was the satellite.
Yeah.
Their uplink was in Vernon Valley, New Jersey.
Right. Yep.
And we did a demonstration that actually sold the concept of going to satellite to the board of directors of NPR by sending an engineer to Vernon Valley with a tape recorder and a modulator. We used, do you remember DBX?
Yeah,
Dave Blackmer?
Sure. Yep.
Okay,
yep.
So we used DBX compression in order to get a decent enough signal-to-noise ratio out of the audio.
On the satellite?
On the satellite.
Okay.
And we used California microwave equipment, modulators and demodulators.
Yeah.
And so we lashed that together. We put a downlink antenna on the roof of NPR at 2025 M Street at the time. In fact, I have photos that you may see this evening of me helping to put that antenna together. That was sufficient quality to demonstrate to the board of directors that this is really the way we wanted to go. And so 4 years after that, we became operational via satellite. And so that was, you know, we put everything out to bid and Coastcom came back and combined the DBX compander with their modulators and demodulators.
So does that mean that without the companding,
it wouldn't have worked?
It wasn't good enough.
It was so noisy you couldn't use
really?
It.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And if you listen to some of the old downlink tapes, you can hear the noise rising along with the modulation.
I do recall hearing noise being modulated way down low. Yeah.
Yeah.
So if we fast forward to today, Steve Johnston was talking a bit about metadata.
Right.
And you know, back in those days, there was no metadata. I mean, we might have gotten something on the DAX printout, right? That says, oh, here, this is coming up, and there may be a bad word at 19 minutes into the show and that kind of stuff. But today...
You really go back a long way.
But today metadata is part of every show and part of your distribution channel needs to include facilities for metadata.
Right. And that's what I've been working on for the past year and a half, 2 years, is this Metapub initiative. And that takes a lot of different forms, but at a minimum, you know, what we're providing now is with Metapub enabled shows that will have the story or the story level metadata that's delivered, and it's actually delivered via the internet. It's not delivered via the satellite system, but it accompanies the material that's being delivered to the station.
I guess we've been talking about metadata briefly, but there's almost, you said story level, and that made me think, well, there's kind of at least two levels of metadata. There's metadata that the consumer is going to get, that's going to get pushed out to the consumer, that maybe he or she could look at closed captioning or could make the show searchable, that would show up on Google if you search for, let's say you interview somebody, Ajit Pai, for example, and you want to know what he said about FM translators on some show on NPR. You could search for that if there was consumer level, show level metadata. And then there's metadata that tells the affiliates about the show, how long it's going to run, when the breaks may be, that kind of thing.
You're right. But the MetaPub initiative really is about metadata that's delivered to the consumers,
okay,
to the listeners. And that's done using HD radio data or RDS streaming. It can be embedded in your streams. Mm-hmm. It can show up on the station's websites. We're working with Tag Station Next Radio too to use them as a delivery mechanism. So that's the initiative that we've been working on. And so it's really, and when I say story level, it's individual stories within All Things Considered, for example. You'll see who the reporter is and what the topic is and so forth. And it's, it shows up on car radios and the like. And that's gotten quite a good reception, and that's what we were talking about this morning.
Yeah. Okay.
The other thing that you're talking about, though, with the DAX going back to our early days, that was originally provided, I think, by Western Union circuits originally back in the early 70s. And then when we went to satellite, we created a system that I was deeply involved in, which was the DAX NetQ receiver decoder, a 2RU box that was about this deep, and 6809 microprocessor, custom software, and it controlled the demodulators, mono stereo switching, and delivered DAX. And, that message, and then queuing, start-stop cues and stuff like that. And we put that together in the early 80s.
Wow. Technology. Man, just moving along. It's amazing. The problems you solve with the tools you had at the time, and our knowledge just keeps building on all that.
It does.
And we get more powerful tools.
Yeah, like this.
Yeah, like that. Exactly.
The smartphone.
Exactly.
And a funny thing about the smartphone, let me see if I can do something real quick here. And I know this probably doesn't work too, but this is actually metadata that's coming from WAMU.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
And this is one of the InnoMini 638 receivers.
Let's see. There we go.
I don't know if that's showing or not.
Almost. If I can get the – now the camera's not going to auto-adjust. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
But that is – so it's –
That's the Inovonix product?
That's the Inovonix 638. And this is a new page that they added to the device at our request that shows the dynamic metadata.
Yes, yeah.
And so this is RDS here, and this is the HD down here. And so they got All Things Considered on the air back in Washington. And we asked them to do this so that we could put something in the control rooms so that the board operators could see, in addition to hearing their audio.
Right.
Could see what their metadata was.
That's so important. And I'm glad Inovonix did that.
They did that.
I hope other people will follow suit because I've set up a few RDS systems myself. And aside from going out and getting in a car and looking at it, how do you know what's going on?
Well, you'd be interested to know that this particular radio that we were just streaming into my phone, it's in the family room of my house in Chesapeake Beach, Maryland.
Of course. Why not?
Wow. Excellent.
Wow.
So, and Inovonix has just been a tremendous partner for us. And that page was designed by our user experience designer at PRSS, Evan Chapman. Let's give Evan a shout out.
And Evan, thank you for making the text big enough for people my age to read easily.
Yeah. But he did a good job. And he, by the way, just became a father a couple of days ago.
Awesome. So. Awesome. Congratulations.
Way to go, Evan.
So anyway, I have so many fun things to play with. I can't possibly consider retiring.
We should have you on the show for a whole hour then sometime.
Well, we can do that.
Yeah, we can do that.
We can do that.
Expect a call from my booker then, okay? No, I got a booker now. So we do.
Yeah, we do.
Yeah. Hey, Wayne, come on, join us. Bruce, thank you for being with us. I'm going to get Wayne on real quick here, and then we're going to take another commercial break, okay?
All righty. Thank you,
Love to have you on for a whole hour.
Thanks,
okay,
Bruce.
Thanks, Chris.
Come on in. Hey, Wayne Pacina is going to join us. He didn't even know he was going to. Come on.
You never know, he'll meet a PREC.
Wayne loves the limelight. He does fantastic webinars. Mm. How you doing, man?
Good
to see you. Thank you, Bruce. Really, really appreciate you. So, hey, we're on. There's the camera right there. We're on This Week in Radio Tech. You've been a guest on the show before.
I have.
So you know how it works.
Yes.
Yeah. I have been watching your webcasts of our, the SBE webinars on security and data security. Yeah.
That's become a hot topic lately.
Did you get to talk to these folks today?
I am this afternoon.
Oh, you are.
That
okay.
is why I'm here.
What's your topic?
What is my topic?
Broadcast IT security.
All right. So I'm the closing act for
now,
the day.
Yes, you are.
Unfortunately, I've got to run to a meeting with my company, Telos. But if I watch all of your webinars from SBE, will I get the same information as you're given here?
You'll get very similar information. Maybe the webinars will be a little bit more in depth, but things will be scaled accordingly for the time.
Yeah.
But I always update things. So no one, you know, there'll be some new content in the presentation today.
But APRE members.
Yeah.
If you want, you can watch the stream of Wayne's presentation today. We're doing live streaming.
That's right. So if you are watching this, yeah, you log into the APRE website.
Using your membership login credentials.
APRE.us. Log in with your credentials.
You can watch everything that's going on here at the conference live.
Yeah. Good deal.
Wayne's information that will be perishable because it won't be today.
Yeah.
You can catch. And it'll be archived. The next time he does, it'll be something different so you can compare it.
If you haven't heard Wayne teach, are you a teacher in real life?
My real life is as a broadcast engineer full time, but I have done teaching primarily on a part-time basis, not a primary.
Well, Wayne walks you through the process of whatever he's teaching, and every step becomes understandable. It builds on the one before, and by the end of it, you've got a complete understanding of the topic at hand.
Well, we hope we can accomplish that with security. You know, security is fairly complex.
It's not easy. Yeah.
And I think a lot of times you get overwhelmed with all of the things that should be done, you need to be done.
Yeah.
And what I try to do is break that down into some practical, more little tangible things that you can do. And I particularly focus on network security as the starting place to simply prevent someone from exploring a network and finding a host. Once you find the host, then there's where the potential compromises comes into play.
So excuse me for just grabbing you. We're going to take a break for a commercial here, but I just want to encourage folks, if you want to be a member of APRE and you're in that world, please do so. If you're not, or if you want to also join SBE and join the Member Plus, you know, paying for it myself, I don't think I could afford to buy all of the webinars that Wayne is doing because I'd have to pay for them individually. Member Plus gets you all the webinars all year long for a whole year for one price.
Yes, and remember, it's more than just my webinars.
Yes,
there's the RF 101 series, which has been one of the more popular series, plus a library that I think last count was well over 60 different webinars.
The topics
of various
are broad.
Yes.
You can catch everything you need. Yep. So if you're an up-and-coming or you just want to get a refresher, they're all there.
Cool. Yeah. Wayne, thank you so much, man.
Well, thank you.
Good to see you.
Thanks, Wayne.
Chris.
It's a pleasure.
We are live this week in Radio Tech number 389, and we're at the Public Radio Engineering Conference in Las Vegas at the Tuscany Hotel. Chris Tobin's along with me, and we're going to take a quick break and hear from our friends at Lavo. When we come back, we're going to do a couple quick things and wrap the show up, and so we'll see you in just a minute.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the jock only uses once in a while, so why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes. And enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavo radio tech at www.lawo.com/twert.
We're back here. Thanks a lot to Lavo for sponsoring this week in Radio Tech. Hey, I just saw Bill Bennett a minute ago.
Bill Bennett's running around, yes.
Yeah, he's running around. Britch, come on in close.
Step in.
You got to pull in here. So we've got just a couple closing minutes of the show. We're going to say goodbye. Then we saw Rich Parks. Hey, Rich, come on over. Uh-huh. So, Rich, we talked to your former colleague, Victoria.
Oh, yeah, Victoria. She's great. She's smart and just a really great board member. I'm so happy to see her and Alice and other people, you know, kind of fill in the APRE board that we were fortunate to be able to help start. And, you know, it's great.
So Rich has been a guest on our show before. Rich was in Vermont, and now he's in Alaska, freezing his katushi off.
No, that's not true. I mean, if you ask Pierre from the folks who live up north, I live in what they call a banana belt. So it's right on the the southeast Alaska is like a rainforest. Maybe it gets zero, really, really cold to zero, and maybe really hot, 65, 70. And it rains a lot.
Now, can you now drive from Juneau out to the rest of the world? Have they finished a road or no?
No.
Okay. So that's why the murder rate in Juneau is so low, because you can't escape.
And they can't find the bodies.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding.
So,
do you know that there's still, you can only get out of Juneau? There's three ways. I've been told there's only three ways to get to Juneau.
Okay.
Fly.
Yeah.
Boat. Or be
born there. Wow.
Yeah. No, it's kind of nice. It's isolated in a way. And I will be honest with you, my wife's here with me this week. And we do like everybody in Juneau has taught us to do. We came down here. We brought an empty suitcase. Because.
What do you bring?
Well, there's things you can't buy up there easily,
so to speak.
Clothes and things, and
oh, okay,
you know, and different whatnot.
I thought maybe
go to Fry's or
yeah.
I mean, you know, you can get stuff on Amazon and all, but it's a pain.
Yeah.
So anyway, no, it's fun. We like being down here. My wife came last night, listened to Gray.
Oh yeah,
Heritage Smith Chart. Talk about Smith Chart.
You posted it on Facebook,
and she was like totally getting into it. I was like, gosh, who's this woman I married? She's like, awesome, right?
Who knew?
Yeah, I get home after the thing, and she's left early. She's like, we got to talk. You got a minute? I'm like, okay, what? So, okay, the impedance and inductance and reactance. I'm like, this is like the craziest pillow talk I've ever had. No, she's
crazy pillow talk.
She's great with
Rich and Karen. So we need to have you back on the show for a full hour sometime.
Well,
it's been too long.
Yep.
So we'll get you back on.
Okay.
I have a booker on the, you know, for the show now. So
my
booker will call your booker and we'll be good.
Your people can call my people.
Yeah, exactly.
Except I don't have any people, but that's okay.
Hey, we were about to wrap out the show, and I'm just not to put you on the spot, but maybe you've come across an engineering tip in the last few weeks that, hey, I'm glad I learned that. Is there something you'd like to maybe pass along to our listeners? A website, a tool, a technique, a crazy little short story you could pass along to us?
What? This isn't mine, but Clive Warner off of the broadcast group posted something about working in Africa, and we were talking about the Smith charts and all that kind of stuff. And he was talking about using an ONB bridge and putting 100 watts into it and putting a neon bulb on a stick and moving it up to find the antinodes in a transmission line. And I'm like, holy cow, that's like amazing, right? Because, you know, you get the peaks and the valleys of the curtain. And when you run the neon up and you see the light change.
Sure.
And he said, then you could mark it with a piece of chalk. And I'm like, he's in Africa doing this. And it's like, that's brilliant.
Wow.
Brilliant kind of engineering that people do. But anyway. That's all I got.
Okay.
That's good.
It's great to see both of you here. Thank you for
coming.
And,
it's good to see you.
Good to see Chris.
Tell you what, if you'll stand here while we close it out.
Absolutely.
That'd be good. We could use another body in here. Chris, thank you for making all the arrangements that you did, especially for the
wireless.
Yeah, the wireless. That's amazing.
It's not impossible.
You talked to the hotel people.
Well, I talked to the APRE people who talked to the hotel people who made arrangements. But I treated them like an ISP.
Yeah.
And in my presentation yesterday, I talked about creating a relationship between the venue and the radio station so you could do this on a more regular basis.
So ordinary engineers, not just you, could accomplish the same
Absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely. This is why it's off the shelf. This is a Coates off the shelf device.
Yeah.
That's why I mentioned that yesterday. It's important that it can't just be the engineer. That person has many things to do. But if you create a system and a workflow that others can follow and you repeatedly and reliably, you now can make money at that. That's what we keep missing.
Yeah,
as Victoria pointed out, we're evolving and we're not paying attention.
By the way, this amazing little device, while you're not using it as a Wi-Fi connection point, you put a whip antenna on the end of there, and you got a lightsaber.
People did make comments yesterday to my omnidirectional antenna as I was walking around. Who's with the lightsaber and ketchup bottle? What's going on here?
We got to go. I want to thank our sponsors, Telus Alliance and the Infinity IP Intercom, shipping now. And also the folks at Lavo and the new Ruby console with the best of manual world and the automatic world all built into one console. Amazing stuff. Thanks a lot for watching, and we'll see you in a week from now. We'll be live at the Telos Alliance booth in the North Hall at the National Association of Broadcasters, where we'll have a lot of folks on camera. Maybe Rich Parker will be able to join us then, too. Maybe if he's still here
next week.
All right. We'll see you next week on This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.